birthday, and I still hadn't told Carl that I wasn't joining up. I'm sure he assumed that I would not, but we didn't discuss it out loud. Embarrassing. I simply arranged to meet him the day after his birthday, and we went down to the recruiting office together. On the steps of the federal building, we ran into Carmencita Ibanez, a classmate of ours and one of the nice things about being a member of a race with two sexes. Carmen wasn't my girl. She wasn't anybody's girl. She never made two dates in a row with the same boy, and treated all of us with equal sweetness, and rather impersonally. But I knew her pretty well, as she often came over and used our swimming pool, because it was Olympic length, sometimes with one boy, sometimes with another, or alone, as Mother urged her to. Mother considered her a good influence. For once, she was right. She saw us and waited, dimpling. "Hello, fellas."
"Hello."
"Olcha Chironya," I answered.
"What brings you here?" "Can't you guess? Today is my birthday." "Huh? Oh, happy returns." "So I'm joining up."
"Oh."
I think Carl was as surprised as I was. But Carmencita was like that. She never gossiped, and she kept her own affairs to herself.
"No fooling?"
I added, brilliantly.
"Why should I be fooling? I'm going to be a spaceship pilot. At least, I'm going to try for it."
"No reason why you shouldn't make it," Carl said quickly. He was right. I know now just how right he was. Carmen was small and neat, perfect health and perfect reflexes. She could make a competitive diving routine look easy, and she was quick in mathematics. Me? I tapered off with a C in algebra and a B in business arithmetic. She took all the math our school offered, and a tutored advanced course on the side. But it had never occurred to me to wonder why. Fact was, little Carmen was so ornamental that you just never thought about her being useful.
I, said Carl, am here to join up too.
And me, I agreed, both of us.
No, I hadn't made any decision. My mouth was leading its own life.
Oh, wonderful.
And I'm going to buck for space pilot too, I added firmly.
She didn't laugh. She answered very seriously. Oh, how grand. Perhaps in training we'll run into each other.
I hope so.
Collision courses? Asked Carl.
That's a no good way to pilot.
Don't be silly, Carl. On the ground, of course. Are you going to be a pilot too?
Me? Carl answered.
No, I'm a truck driver. You know me. Starside R&D. If they'll have me. Electronics.
Truck driver, indeed. I hope they stick you out on Pluto and let you freeze.
No, I don't.
Good luck.
Let's go in, shall we?
The recruiting station was inside a railing in the rotunda. A fleet sergeant sat at a desk there, in dress uniform, gaudy as a circus. His chest was loaded with ribbons I couldn't read, but his right arm was off so short that his tunic had been tailored without any sleeve at all. And when you came up to the rail, you could see that he had no legs.
It didn't seem to bother him.
Carl said, "Good morning, I want to join up." "Me too," I added.
He ignored us. He managed to bow while sitting down and said, "Good morning, young lady. What can I do for you?"
"I want to join up too."
He smiled. "Good girl. If you'll just scoot up to room 201 and ask for Major Rojas, she'll take care of you."
He looked her up and down.
"Pilot?"
"If possible."
"You look like one. Well, see Miss Rojas."
She left, with thanks to him and a see you later to us. He turned his attention to us, sized us up with a total absence of the pleasure he had shown little Carmen.
"So," he said, "for what? Labor battalions?"
"Oh, no," I said. "I'm going to be a pilot." He stared at me and simply turned his eyes away.
"You?"
"I'm interested in the Research and Development Corps," Carl said soberly. especially electronics. I understand the chances are pretty good.
They are, if you can cut it, the fleet sergeant said grimly.
And not if you don't have what it takes, both in preparation and ability.
Look, boys, have you any idea why they have me out here in front?
I didn't understand him. Carl said, Why?
Because the government doesn't care one bucket of swill whether you join or not. Because it has become stylish with some people, too many people, to serve a term and earn a franchise and be able to wear a ribbon on your lapel which says that you are a veteran, whether you've ever seen combat or not. But if you want to serve, and I can't talk you out of it, then we have to take you, because that's your constitutional right. It says that everybody, male or female, shall have his born right to pay his service and assume full citizenship. But the facts are that we are getting hard pushed to find things for all the volunteers to do that aren't just glorified KP. You can't all be real military men. We don't need that many, and most of the volunteers aren't number one soldier material anyhow. Got any idea what it takes to make a soldier?
No, I admitted.
Most people think that all it takes is two hands and 2 feet and a stupid mind.
Maybe so, for cannon fodder.
Possibly that was all that Julius Caesar required. But a private soldier today is a specialist so highly skilled that he would rate master in any other trade. We can't afford stupid ones. So for those who insist on serving their term but haven't got what we want and must have, we've had to think up a whole list of dirty, nasty, dangerous jobs that will either run 'em home with their tails between their legs and make their terms uncompleted, or at the very least make 'em remember for the rest of their lives that their citizenship is valuable to them, because they've paid a high price for it. Take that young lady who is here. Wants to be a pilot. I hope she makes it. We always need good pilots. Not enough of 'em.
Maybe she will. But if she misses, she may wind up in Antarctica, her pretty eyes red from never seeing anything but artificial light, and her knuckles calloused from hard, dirty work.
I wanted to tell him that the least Carmencita could get was computer programmer for the Skywatch. She really was a whiz at math, but he was talking.
So they put me out here to discourage you boys. Look at this. He shoved his chair around to make sure that we could see that he was legless. Let's assume you don't wind up digging tunnels on Luna or playing human guinea pig for new diseases through sheer lack of talent. Suppose we do make a fighting man out of you. Take a look at me. This is what you may buy, if you don't buy the whole farm and cause your folks to receive a deeply regret telegram, which is more likely, because these days in training or in combat, there aren't many wounded. If you buy it all, they'll likely throw in a coffin. I'm the rare exception. I was lucky. Though maybe you wouldn't call it lucky.
He paused, then added, So why don't you boys go home, go to college, and then go be chemists or insurance brokers or whatever? A term of service isn't a kiddie camp. It's either real military service, rough and dangerous, even in peacetime, or a more unreasonable facsimile thereof. Not a vacation, not a romantic adventure.
Well,
Carl said, I'm here to join up.
Me too.
You realize that you aren't allowed to pick your service.
Carl said, I thought we could state our preferences.
Certainly. And that's the last choice you'll make until the end of your term. The placement officer pays attention to your choice, too. First thing he does is to check whether there's any demand for left-handed glass blowers this week, that being what you think would make you happy. Having reluctantly conceded that there is a need for your choice, probably at the bottom of the Pacific, he then tests you for innate ability and preparation. About one in 20 times, he is forced to admit that everything matches and you get the job, until some practical joker gives you dispatch orders to do something very different. But the other 19 times, he turns you down,
and decides that you are just what they have been needing to field test survival equipment on Titan. He added meditatively, "It's chilly on Titan, and it's amazing how often experimental equipment fails to work. Have to have real field tests, though. Laboratories just never get all the answers."
"I can qualify for electronics," Carl said firmly, "if there are jobs open in it."
"So? And how about you, Bub?"
I hesitated, and suddenly realized that if I didn't take a swing at it, I would wonder all my life whether I was anything but the boss's son.
"I'm going to chance it."
"Well, you can't say I didn't try. Got your birth certificates with you? Then let's see your IDs."
10 minutes later, still not sworn in, we were on the top floor being prodded and poked and fluoroscoped. I decided that the idea of a physical examination is that, if you aren't ill, then they do their darndest to make you ill. If the attempt fails, you're in. I asked one of the doctors what percentage of the victims flunked the physical. He looked startled.
"Why, we never fail anyone. The law doesn't permit us to."
"Huh? I mean, excuse me, doctor. Then what's the point of this goose flesh parade?"
"Why, the purpose is," he answered, hauling off and hitting me in the knee with a hammer. I kicked him, but not hard. "To find out what duties you are physically able to perform. But if you came in here in a wheelchair and blind in both eyes and were silly enough to insist on enrolling, they would find something silly enough to match. Counting the fuzz on a caterpillar by touch, maybe. The only way you can fail is by having the psychiatrists decide that you are not able to understand the oath."
"Oh. Doctor? Were you already a doctor when you joined up, or did they decide you ought to be a doctor and sent you to school?"
"Me?" He seemed shocked.
"Youngster, do I look that silly? I'm a civilian employee."
"Oh, sorry, sir."
"No offense, but military service is for ants, believe me. I see 'em go, I see 'em come back, when they do come back. I see what's done to 'em. And for what? A purely nominal political privilege that pays not one centavo. And that most of them aren't competent to use wisely anyhow. Now, if they would let medical men run things. But never mind that. You might think I was talking treason, free speech or not. But, youngster, if you're savvy enough to count 10, you'll back out while you still can. Here, take these papers back to the recruiting sergeant, and remember what I said." I went back to the rotunda. Carl was already there. The fleet sergeant looked over my papers and said glumly, "Apparently you both are almost insufferably healthy, except for holes in your head." "One moment while I get some witnesses." He punched a button and two female clerks came out. One old battle axe, one kind of cute. He pointed to our physical examination forms, our birth certificates, our IDs, said formally, "I invite and require you, each and severally, to examine these exhibits, determine that they are, and to determine, each independently, what relation, if any, each document bears to these two men standing here in your presence." They treated it as a dull routine, which I'm sure it was. Nevertheless, they scrutinized every document. They took our fingerprints again, and the cute one put a jeweler's loop in her eye and compared prints from birth to now. She did the same with signatures. I began to doubt if I was myself. The fleet sergeant added, "Did you find exhibits relating to their present competence to take the oath of enrollment? If so, what?" "We found," the older one said, "appended to each record of physical examination, a duly certified conclusion by an authorized and delegated board of psychiatrists stating that each of them is mentally competent to take the oath, and that neither one is under the influence of alcohol, narcotics, other disabling drugs, nor of hypnosis.
Very good.
He turned to us.
Repeat after me. I, being of legal age, of my own free will.
I, we each echoed, being of legal age, of my own free will.
Without coercion, promise, or inducement of any sort, have, after being duly advised and warned of the meaning and consequences of this oath,
do now enroll in the federal service of the Terran Federation for a term of not less than 2 years, and as much longer as may be required by the needs of the service.
I gulped a little over that part. I'd always thought of a term as 2 years, even though I knew better, because that's the way people talk about it.
Why, we were signing up for life.
I swear to uphold and defend the Constitution of the Federation against all its enemies, on or off Terra, to protect and defend the constitutional liberties and privileges of all citizens and lawful residents of the Federation, its associated states and territories, to perform, on or off Terra, such duties as any lawful nature as may be assigned to me by lawful direct or delegated authority, and to obey all lawful orders of the Commander-in-Chief of the Terran Service, and of all officers or delegated persons placed over me, and to require such obedience from all members of the service and other persons or non-human beings lawfully placed under my orders. And, on being honorably discharged at the completion of my full term of active service, or upon being placed on inactive retired status after having completed such full term, to carry out all duties and obligations, and to enjoy all privileges of Federation citizenship, including, but not limited to, the duty, obligation, and privilege of exercising sovereign franchise for the rest of my natural life, unless stripped of honor by verdict, finally sustained, of court of my sovereign peers.
Phew!
Mr. Dubois had analyzed the service oath for us in history and moral philosophy, and had made us study it phrase by phrase. But you don't really feel the size of the thing until it comes rolling over you, all in one ungainly piece, as heavy and unstoppable as Juggernaut's carriage. At least it made me realize that I was no longer a civilian, with my shirt tail out and nothing on my mind. I didn't know yet what I was, but I knew what I wasn't.
So help me God, we both ended, and Carl crossed himself, and so did the cute one.
After that, there were more signatures and fingerprints, all five of us, and flat color graphs of Carl and me were snapped then and there and embossed into our papers. The fleet sergeant finally looked up.
Why, it's way past the break for lunch. Time for chow, lads.
I swallowed hard. Sergeant?
Speak up.
Can I flash my folks from here? Tell them how it came out?
We can do better than that.
Sir? You go on 48 hours leave now. He grinned coldly. Do you know what happens if you don't come back?
Court-martial?
Not a thing. Not a blessed thing. Except that your papers get marked, term not completed satisfactorily. And you never, never, never get a second chance. This is our cooling-off period, during which we shake out the overgrown babies who didn't really mean it and should never have taken the oath. It saves the government money, and it saves a power of grief for such kids and their parents. The neighbors needn't guess. You don't even have to tell your parents. He shoved his chair away from his desk.
So, I'll see you at noon, day after tomorrow, if I see you.
Fetch your personal effects.
It was a crummy leave.
Father stormed at me, then quit speaking to me. Mother took to her bed. When I finally left, an hour earlier than I had to, nobody saw me off but the morning cook and the houseboys. I stopped in front of the recruiting sergeant's desk, thought about saluting, and decided I didn't know how.
He looked up.
Oh. Here are your papers. Take them up to room 201. They'll start you through the mill. Knock and walk in.
2 days later, I knew I was not going to be a pilot. Some of the things the examiners wrote about me were insufficient intuitive grasp of spatial relationships, insufficient mathematical talent, deficient mathematical preparation, reaction time adequate, eyesight good. I'm glad they put in those last two. I was beginning to feel that counting on my fingers was my speed. The placement officer let me list my lesser preferences in order, and I caught 4 more days of the wildest aptitude tests I've ever heard of. I mean to say, what do they find out when a stenographer jumps on her chair and screams, "Snakes!" There was no snake, just a harmless piece of plastic hose. The written and oral tests were mostly just as silly, but they seemed happy with them, so I took them. The thing I did most carefully was to list my preferences. Naturally, I listed all of the Space Navy jobs, other than pilot, at the top. Whether I went as power room technician or as cook, I knew that I preferred any Navy job to any Army job. I wanted to travel. Next, I listed intelligence. A spy gets around, too. And I figured that it couldn't possibly be dull. I was wrong, but never mind. After that came a long list. Psychological warfare, chemical warfare, biological warfare, combat ecology. I didn't know what it was, but it sounded interesting. Logistics Corps. A simple mistake. I had studied logic for the debate team, and logistics turns out to have 2 entirely separate meanings. And a dozen others. Clear at the bottom, with some hesitation, I put Canine Corps, and infantry. I didn't bother to list the various non-combatant auxiliary corps because if I wasn't picked for a combat corps, I didn't care whether they used me as an experimental animal or sent me as a laborer to the terranizing of Venus. Either one was a booby prize. Mr. Weiss, the placement officer, sent for me a week after I was sworn in. He was actually a retired psychological warfare major on active duty for procurement. But he wore mufti and insisted on being called just Mr., and you could relax and take it easy with him. He had my list of preferences and the reports on all my tests, and I saw that he was holding my high school transcript, which pleased me, for I had done all right in school. I had stood high enough, without standing so high, as to be marked as a greasy grind, having never flunked any courses and dropped only one. And I had been rather a big man around school otherwise. Swimming team, debate team, track squad, class treasurer, silver medal in the annual literary contest, chairman of the homecoming committee, stuff like that. A well-rounded record, and it's all down in the transcript. He looked up as I came in, said, "Sit down, Johnny," and looked back at the transcript, then put it down. "You like dogs?" "Huh? Yes, sir." "How well do you like them? Did your dog sleep on your bed? By the way, where is your dog now?" "Why, I don't happen to have a dog just at present. But when I did, well, no, he didn't sleep on my bed. You see, Mother didn't allow dogs in the house."
"But didn't you sneak him in?"
"Huh?" I thought of trying to explain Mother's not angry but terribly hurt routine. When you tried to buck her on something she had her mind made up about. But I gave up. "No, sir."
"Hmm.
Have you ever seen a Neo dog?"
Once, sir. They exhibited one at the MacArthur Theater 2 years ago, but the SPCA made trouble for them.
"Let me tell you how it is with a canine team. A Neo dog is not just a dog that talks." "I couldn't understand that Neo at the MacArthur. Do they really talk?"
"They talk.
You simply have to train your ear to their accent. Their mouths can't shape B, M, P, or V, and you have to get used to their equivalents. Something like the handicap of a split palate, but with different letters. No matter. Their speech is as clear as any human speech. But a neo-dog is not a talking dog. He is not a dog at all. He is an artificially mutated symbiote, derived from dog stock. A neo, a trained Caleb, is about 6 times as bright as a dog. Say about as intelligent as a human moron, except that the comparison is not fair to the neo. A moron is a defective, whereas a neo is a stable genius in his own line of work. Mr. Weiss scowled. Provided, that is, that he has his symbiote. That's the rub. You're too young ever to have married, but you've seen marriage. Your own parents, at least. Can you imagine being married to a Caleb? No, I can't. The emotional relationship between the dog man and the man dog in the canine team is a great deal closer and much more important than the emotional relationship in most marriages. If the master is killed, we kill the neo dog at once. It is all that we can do for the poor thing. A mercy killing. If the neo dog is killed, well, we can't kill the man, even though it would be the simplest solution. Instead, we restrain him and hospitalize him and slowly put him back together. He picked up a pen, made a mark. I don't think we can risk assigning a boy to canine who didn't outwit his mother to have his dog sleep with him. So let's consider something else. It was not until then that I realized that I must have already flunked every choice on my list above canine core. And now I had just flunked it, too. I was so startled that I almost missed his next remark. Major Y said meditatively, with no expression and as if he were talking about someone else long dead and far away. I was once half of a canine team. When my Caleb became a casualty, they kept me under sedation for 6 weeks. Then rehabilitated me for other work. Johnny, these courses you've taken, why didn't you study something useful? Sir? Too late now, forget it. Your instructor in history and moral philosophy seems to think well of you.
He does?
I was surprised. What did he say?
Weiss smiled. He says that you are not stupid, merely ignorant and prejudiced by your environment. From him, that is high praise. I know him.
It didn't sound like praise to me. That stuck-up, stiff-necked old...
And, Weiss went on, a boy who gets a C- in appreciation of television can't be all bad. I think we'll accept Mr. Dubois' recommendation. How would you like to be an infantryman? I came out of the federal building feeling subdued, yet not really unhappy. At least I was a soldier. I had papers in my pocket to prove it. I hadn't been classed as too dumb and useless for anything but make work. It was a few minutes after the end of the workday and the buildings were empty, save for a skeleton night staff and a few stragglers. I ran into a man in the rotunda who was just leaving. His face looked familiar, but I couldn't place him. But he caught my eye and recognized me.
Evening, he said briskly.
You haven't shipped out yet.
And then I recognized him. The fleet sergeant who had sworn us in. I guess my chin dropped. This man was in civilian clothes and walking around on 2 legs and had 2 arms.
Good evening, sergeant, I mumbled.
He understood my expression perfectly, glanced down at himself and smiled easily.
Relax, lad. I don't have to put on my horror show after working hours, and I don't.
You haven't been placed yet.
I just got my orders.
For what?
Mobile infantry.
His face broke in a big grin of delight, and he shoved out his hand.
My outfit. Shake, son. They'll make a man out of you, or kill you trying. Maybe both.
It's a good choice, I said doubtfully.
A good choice? Son, it's the only choice. The mobile infantry is the army. All the others are either button pushers or professors, along merely to hand us the saw. We do the work. He shook hands again and added, Drop me a card. Fleet Sergeant Ho, Federal Building. That'll reach me. Good luck. And he was off. Shoulders back, heels clicking, head up. I looked at my hand. The hand he had offered me was the one that wasn't there, his right hand. Yet it had felt like flesh, and had shaken mine firmly. I had read about these powered prosthetics, but it is startling when you first run across them. I went back to the hotel where recruits were temporarily billeted during placement. We didn't even have uniforms yet, just plain coveralls we wore during the day and our own clothes after hours. I went to my room and started packing. As I was shipping out early in the morning. Packing to send stuff home, I mean. Weiss had cautioned me not to take along anything but family photographs and possibly a musical instrument, if I played one, which I didn't. Carl had shipped out 3 days earlier, having gotten the R&D assignment he wanted. I was just as glad, as he would have been just too confounded understanding about the billet I had drawn. Little Carmen had shipped out too, with a rank of cadet midshipman, probationary. She was going to be a pilot, all right, if she could cut it, and I suspected that she could. My temporary roomie came in while I was packing. Got your orders? He asked. Yep. What? Mobile infantry. The infantry? Ah, you poor stupid clown. I feel sorry for you, I really do. I straightened up and said angrily, Shut up! The mobile infantry is the best outfit in the army. It is the army. The rest of you jerks are just along to hand us the saw. We do the work. He laughed. You'll find out. You want a mouthful of knuckles? 3. He shall rule them with a rod of iron. Revelations 2:25. I did basic at Camp Arthur Currie on the northern prairies, along with a couple of 1,000 other victims. And I do mean camp, as the only permanent buildings there were to shelter equipment. We slept and ate in tents. We lived outdoors, if you call that living, which I didn't, at the time. I was used to a warm climate. It seemed to me that the North Pole was just 5 miles north of camp and getting closer. Ice age returning, no doubt. But exercise will keep you warm, and they saw to it that we got plenty of that. The first morning we were there, they woke us up before daybreak. I had had trouble adjusting to the change in time zones, and it seemed to me that I had just got to sleep. I couldn't believe that anyone seriously intended that I should get up in the middle of the night. But they did mean it. A speaker somewhere was blaring out a military march, fit to wake the dead, and a hairy nuisance who had come charging down the company street yelling, Everybody out, show a leg, on the bounce, came marauding back in again just as I had pulled the covers over my head, tipped over my cot and dumped me on the cold, hard ground. It was an impersonal attention. He didn't even wait to see if I hit. 10 minutes later, dressed in trousers, undershirt and shoes, I was lined up with the others in ragged ranks for sit-up exercises, just as the sun looked over the eastern horizon. Facing us was a big, broad-shouldered, mean-looking man, dressed just as we were, except that while I looked and felt like a poor job of embalming, his chin was shaved blue, his trousers were sharply creased, he could have used his shoes for mirrors, and his manner was alert, wide awake, relaxed, and rested. You got the impression that he never needed sleep. Just 10,000-mile checkups and dust him off occasionally. He bellowed, Captain, attention! I'm Career Ship Sergeant Zim, your company commander. When you speak to me, you will salute and say, Sir. You will salute and sir anyone who carries an instructor's baton. He was carrying a swagger cane, and now made a quick reverse moulinet with it, to show what he meant by an instructor's baton. I had noticed men carrying them when we had arrived the night before and had intended to get one myself. They looked smart. Now, I changed my mind. Because we don't have enough officers around here for you to practice on. You'll have to practice on us. Who sneezed? No answer. Who sneezed?
I did, a voice answered.
I did what?
I sneezed.
I sneezed, sir.
I sneezed, sir.
I'm cold, sir. Aha!
Zim strode up to the man who had sneezed, shoved the ferrule of the swagger cane an inch under his nose, and demanded, "Name?"
"Jenkins, sir."
"Jenkins," Zim repeated, as if the word were somehow distasteful, even shameful. "I suppose some night on patrol you're going to sneeze just because you've got a runny nose, huh?"
"I hope not, sir."
"So do I. But you're cold. We'll fix that." He pointed with his stick. "See that armory over there?"
I looked and could see nothing but prairie except for one building that seemed to be almost on the skyline.
"Fall out. Run around it." "Run," I said, "fast. Bronski, pace him."
"Right, Sarge."
One of the five or six other baton carriers took out after Jenkins, caught up with him easily, cracked him across the tight of his pants with a baton. Zim turned back to the rest of us, still shivering at attention. He walked up and down, looked us over, and seemed awfully unhappy. At last, he stepped out in front of us, shook his head, and said, apparently to himself, but he had a voice that carried,
"To think that this had to happen to me."
He looked at us.
"You apes." "No, not apes. You don't rate that much." "You pitiful mob of sickly monkeys. You sunken-chested, slack-bellied, drooling refugees from apron strings. In my whole life I never saw such a disgraceful huddle of mamas, spoiled little darlings, and you, there. Suck up the gut. Eyes front, I'm talking to you."
I pulled in my belly, even though I was not sure he had addressed me. He went on and on, and I began to forget my goose flesh in hearing him storm. He never once repeated himself, and he never used either profanity or obscenity. I learned later that he saved those for very special occasions, which this wasn't. But he described our shortcomings, physical, mental, moral, and genetic, in great and insulting detail. But somehow, I was not insulted. I became greatly interested in studying his command of language. I wished that we had had him on our debate team. At last he stopped and seemed about to cry. "I can't stand it," he said bitterly. "I've just got to work some of it off. I had a better set of wooden soldiers when I was 6. All right. Is there any of you jungle lice who thinks he can whip me? Is there a man in the crowd? Speak up."
There was a short silence, to which I contributed.
I didn't have any doubt at all that he could whip me. I was convinced.
I heard a voice far down the line, the tall end.
"I reckon I can, sir."
Zim looked happy.
"Good. Step out here where I can see you."
The recruit did so, and he was impressive, at least 3 inches taller than Sergeant Zim, and broader across the shoulders.
"What's your name, soldier?"
"Breckenridge, sir, and I weigh 210 pounds, and there ain't any of it slack-bellied."
"Any particular way you'd like to fight?"
"Sir, you just pick your own method of dying. I'm not fussy."
"Okay, no rules. Start when you like."
Zim tossed his baton aside. It started. And it was over. The big recruit was sitting on the ground, holding his left wrist in his right hand. He didn't say anything. Zim bent over him.
"Broken?"
Reckon it might be, sir.
I'm sorry, you hurried me a little. Do you know where the dispensary is? Never mind. Jones, take Breckenridge over to the dispensary. As they left, Zim slapped him on the right shoulder and said quietly, Let's try it again in a month or so. I'll show you what happened. I think it was meant to be a private remark, but they were standing about 6 feet in front of where I was slowly freezing solid. Zim stepped back and called out, Okay, we got one man in this company at least. I feel better. Do we have another one? Do we have two more? Any two of you scrofulous toads think you can stand up to me? He looked back and forth along our ranks. Chicken-livered, spineless... Oh. Oh, yes? Step out. Two men who had been side by side in ranks stepped out together. I suppose they had arranged it in whispers right there, but they also were far down the tall end, so I didn't hear. Zim smiled at them. Names for your next of kin, please.
Heinrich.
Heinrich what?
Heinrich, sir, bitte.
He spoke rapidly to the other recruit and added politely,
He doesn't speak much standard English yet, sir.
Meyer, mein Herr,
the second man supplied. That's okay, lots of them don't speak much of it when they get here. I didn't myself. Tell Meyer not to worry. He'll pick it up. But he understands what we are going to do?
Jawohl, agreed Meyer.
Certainly, sir, he understands standard. He just can't speak it fluently.
All right. Where did you two pick up those face scars? Heidelberg?
No, sir. Königsberg.
Same thing. Zim had picked up his baton after fighting Breckenridge. He twirled it and asked, Perhaps you would each like to borrow one of these.
It would not be fair to you, sir.
Heinrich answered carefully.
Bear hands, if you please.
Suit yourself, although I might fool you. Königsberg, eh? Rules?
How can there be rules, sir, with three?
An interesting point. Well, let's agree that if eyes are gouged out, they must be handed back when it's over. Until you're Kopfbruder, then I'm ready now. Start when you like.
Zim tossed his baton away. Someone caught it.
You joke, sir. We will not gouge eyes.
No eye gouging agreed. Fire when ready, Gridley.
Please?
Come on and fight, or get back into ranks.
Now, I am not sure that I saw it happen this way. I may have learned part of it later in training. But here is what I think happened. The two moved out on each side of our company commander until they had him completely flanked, but well out of contact. From this position, there is a choice of four basic moves for a man working alone, moves that take advantage of his own mobility and of the superior coordination of one man as compared with two. Sergeant Zim says, correctly, that any group is weaker than a man alone unless they are perfectly trained to work together. For example, Zim could have feinted at one of them, bounced fast to the other with a disabler, such as a broken kneecap, then finished off the first at his leisure. Instead, he let them attack.
Meyer came at him fast, intending to body check him and knock him to the ground, I think, while Heinrich would follow through from above, maybe with his boots. That's the way it appeared to start. And here's what I think I saw. Meyer never reached him with that body check. Sergeant Zim whirled to face him while kicking out and getting Heinrich in the belly, and then Meyer was sailing through the air, his lunge helped along with a hearty assist from Zim. But all I am sure of is that the fight started and then there were two German boys sleeping peacefully, almost end to end, one face down and one face up. And Zim was standing over them, not even breathing hard.
Jones, he said. No, Jones left, didn't he?
Mahmoud, let's have the bucket of water, then stick them back into their sockets.
Who's got my toothpick?
A few moments later, the two were conscious, wet, and back in ranks. Zim looked at us and inquired gently, "Anybody else? Or shall we get on with setting up exercises?"
I didn't expect anybody else, and I doubted if he did. But from down on the left flank, where the shorties hung out, a boy stepped out of ranks, came front and center. Zim looked down at him.
"Just you? Or do you want to pick a partner?"
"Just myself, sir."
"As you say. Name?"
"Shijumi, sir."
Zim's eyes widened. "Any relation to Colonel Shijumi?"
"I have the honor to be his son, sir."
"Ah, so. Well, black belt?"
"No, sir, not yet."
"I'm glad you qualified that. Well, Shijumi, are we going to use contact rules or shall I send for the ambulance?"
"As you wish, sir. But I think, if I may be permitted an opinion, that contest rules would be more prudent."
"I don't know just how you mean that, but I agree." Zim tossed his badge of authority aside. Then, so help me, they backed off, faced each other, and bowed. After that, they circled around each other in a half-crouch, making tentative passes with their hands, and looking like a couple of roosters. Suddenly they touched, and the little chap was down on the ground and Sergeant Zim was flying through the air over his head. But he didn't land with the dull, breath-paralyzing thud that Mare had. He hit rolling and was on his feet as fast as Shijumi was, and facing him.
"Banzai," Zim yelled and grinned.
"Arigato," Shijumi answered and grinned back. They touched again, almost without a pause, and I thought the sergeant was going to fly again. He didn't. He slithered straight in. There was a confusion of arms and legs, and when the motion slowed down, you could see that Zim was tucking Shujumi's left foot in his right ear. A poor fit. Shijumi slapped the ground with a free hand. Zim let him up at once. They again bowed to each other.
"Another fall, sir?"
"Sorry, we've got work to do. Some other time, huh? For fun? And honor? Perhaps I should have told you. Your honorable father trained me."
"So I had already surmised, sir. Another time it is."
Zim slapped him hard on the shoulder. "Back in ranks, soldier."
"Company!"
Then, for 20 minutes, we went through calisthenics that left me dripping hot, as I had been shivering cold. Zim led it himself, doing it all with us and shouting the count. He hadn't been mussed that I could see. He wasn't breathing hard as we finished. He never led the exercises after that morning. We never saw him again before breakfast. Rank hath its privileges. But he did that morning, and when it was over and we were all bushed, he led us at a trot to the mess tent, shouting at us the whole way to step it up, on the bounce. You're dragging your tails. We always trotted everywhere at Camp Arthur Curry. I never did find out who Curry was, but he must have been a track man. Breckenridge was already in the mess tent with a cast on his wrist, but thumb and fingers showing. I heard him say, "Nah, just a green stick fracture. I've played a whole quarter with worse. Will you wait? I'll fix him." I had my doubts. Shijumi, maybe, but not that big ape. He simply didn't know when he was outclassed. I disliked Zim from the first moment I laid eyes on him, but he had style. Breakfast was all right. All the meals were all right. There was none of that nonsense some boarding schools have of making your life miserable at the table. If you wanted to slump down and shovel it in with both hands, nobody bothered you, which was good, as meals were practically the only time somebody wasn't riding you. The menu for breakfast wasn't anything like what I had been used to at home, and the civilians that waited on us
slapped the food around in a fashion that would have made Mother grow pale and leave for her room. But it was hot, and it was plentiful, and the cooking was okay, if plain. I ate about 4 times what I normally do and washed it down with mug after mug of coffee with cream and lots of sugar. I would have eaten a shark without stopping to skin him. Jenkins showed up with Corporal Bronski behind him as I started on seconds. They stopped for a moment at the table where Zim was eating alone. Then Jenkins slumped onto a vacant stool by mine. He looked mighty seedy, pale, exhausted, his breath rasping. I said, "Here, let me pour you some coffee." He shook his head. "You better eat," I insisted. "Some scrambled eggs? They'll go down easily." "Can't eat. Oh, that dirty, dirty so-and-so." He began cussing out Zim in a low, almost expressionless monotone. All I asked him was to let me go lie down and skip breakfast. Bronski wouldn't let me. Said I had to see the company commander. So I did, and I told him I was sick. I told him. He just felt my cheek and counted my pulse and told me sick call was 9 o'clock. Wouldn't let me go back to my tent. Oh, that rat. I'll catch him in a dark night. I will. I spooned out some eggs for him anyway and poured coffee. Presently, he began to eat. Sergeant Zim got up to leave while most of us were still eating and stopped by our table. "Jenkins?" "Yes, sir." "At 0900, muster for sick call and see the doctor." Jenkins' jaw muscles twitched. He answered slowly. "I don't need any pills, sir. I'll get by." "0900, that's an order." He left. Jenkins started his monotonous chant again. Finally, he slowed down, took a bite of eggs, and said somewhat more loudly, "I can't help wondering what kind of a mother produced that. I'd just like to have a look at her, that's all. Did he ever have a mother?" It was a rhetorical question, but it got answered. At the head of our table, several stools away, was one of the instructor corporals. He had finished eating and was smoking and picking his teeth simultaneously. He had evidently been listening. "Jenkins?"
Sir?
"Don't you know about sergeants?"
"Well, I'm learning."
"They don't have mothers. Just ask any trained private." He blew smoke toward us. "They produce by fission, like all bacteria."
4. And the Lord said unto Gideon, "The people that are with thee are too many. Now therefore go to, proclaim in the ears of the people, saying, Whosoever is fearful and afraid, let him return. And there returned of the people 22,000, and there remained 10,000. And the Lord said unto Gideon, The people are yet too many. Bring them down unto the water, and I will try them for thee there. So he brought down the people unto the water, and the Lord said unto Gideon, Every one that lappeth of the water with his tongue as a dog lappeth, him shalt thou set by himself. Likewise any one that boweth down upon his knees to drink. And the number of them that drank, putting their hand to their mouth, were 300 men. And the Lord said unto Gideon, By the 300 will I save you. Let all the other people go. Judges 7, verses 2 through 7. 2 weeks after we got there, they took our cots away from us. That is to say, that we had the dubious pleasure of folding them, carrying them 4 miles, and stowing them in a warehouse. By then it didn't matter. The ground seemed much warmer and quite soft, especially when the alert sounded in the middle of the night and we had to scramble out and play soldier, which it did about 3 times a week. But I could get back to sleep after one of those mock exercises at once. I had learned to sleep any place, any time, sitting up, standing up, even marching in ranks. Why, I could even sleep through evening parade standing at attention,
enjoying the music without being wakened by it, and wake instantly at the command to pass in review. I made a very important discovery at Camp Curie. Happiness consists in getting enough sleep. Just that, nothing more. All the wealthy, unhappy people you've ever met taking sleeping pills, mobile infantrymen don't need them. Give a cap trooper a bunk and time to sack out in it, and he's as happy as a worm in an apple, asleep. Theoretically, you were given 8 full hours of sack time every night, and about an hour and a half after evening chow for your own use. But in fact, your night sack time was subjected to alerts, to night duty, to field marches, and to acts of God, and the whims of those over you. And your evenings, if not ruined by awkward squad or extra duty for minor offenses, were likely to be taken up by shining shoes, doing laundry, swapping haircuts. Some of us got to be pretty fair barbers. But a clean sweep like a billiard ball was acceptable, and anybody can do that. Not to mention 1,000 other chores having to do with equipment, person, and demands of sergeants. For example, we learned to answer morning roll call with bathed, meaning you had taken at least one bath since last reveille. A man might lie about it and get away with it. I did a couple of times. But at least one in our company who pulled that dodge, in the face of convincing evidence that he was not recently bathed, got scrubbed with stiff brushes and floor soap by his squad mates, while a corporal instructor chaperoned and made helpful suggestions. But if you didn't have more urgent things to do after supper, you could write a letter, loaf, gossip, discuss the myriad mental and moral shortcomings of sergeants, and, dearest of all, talk about the female of the species. We became convinced that there were no such creatures, just mythology created by inflamed imaginations. One boy in our company claimed to have seen a girl over at regimental headquarters. He was unanimously judged a liar and a braggart. Or you could play cards. I learned the hard way not to draw to an inside straight, and I've never done it since. In fact, I haven't played cards since. Or, if you actually did have 20 minutes of your very own, you could sleep. This was a choice very highly thought of. We were always several weeks minus on sleep. I may have given the impression that boot camp was made harder than necessary. This is not correct. It was made as hard as possible and on purpose. It was the firm opinion of every recruit that this was sheer meanness, calculated sadism, fiendish delight of witless morons in making other people suffer. It was not. It was too scheduled, too intellectual, too efficiently and impersonally organized to be cruelty for the sick pleasure of cruelty. It was planned like surgery, for purposes as unimpassioned as those of a surgeon. Oh, I admit that some of the instructors may have enjoyed it, but I don't know that they did. And I do know, now, that the psych officers tried to weed out any bullies in selecting instructors. They looked for skilled and dedicated craftsmen to follow the art of making things as tough as possible for a recruit. A bully is too stupid, himself too emotionally involved and too likely to grow tired of his fun and slack off to be efficient. Still, there may have been bullies among them, but I've heard that some surgeons, and not necessarily bad ones, enjoy the cutting and the blood which accompanies the humane art of surgery. And that's what it was, surgery. Its immediate purpose was to get rid of, run right out of the outfit, those recruits who were too soft or too babyish ever to make mobile infantrymen. It accomplished that in droves. They darn near ran me out. Our company shrank to platoon size in the first 6 weeks. Some of them were dropped without prejudice and allowed, if they wished, to sweat out their terms in the non-combatant services. Others got
bad conduct discharges, or unsatisfactory performance discharges, or medical discharges.